Welcome to Magic in the Moment, mindfulness in real time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath. Just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment and doing this intentionally can create that same magic. And our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. This episode is sponsored by Meditation for Leadership, bringing the power of mindfulness to leaders and teams. Clear thinking, stronger connections, and better decision-making can start with just a few moments of mindfulness meditation. Meditation for Leadership offers live, interactive training programs that blend neuroscience and practical techniques to build resilience, emotional intelligence, and focus, so you can lead with confidence and clarity. Experience the difference mindful leadership makes. Visit meditationforleadership.org to learn more. My guest today is Sonia Pemberton, who weaves mindfulness into her personal and professional life in this same unique way. And it's paid dividends in her relationships and has helped inform how she coaches and trains her clients. Sonia is an international speaker, neuroconscious thought leader, and she helps organizations and their leaders future-proof and thrive in uncertainty through neuroconscious foresight. So, Sonia, you were telling me about being up on Cape Cod in the midst of Hurricane Sandy and being in, I guess, a conference with 60, 65 other people in the midst of the wind and the storm going outside, and somehow being able to maintain a sense of calm and collect, despite the fact that many of the people who were with you were from Europe, had never experienced a hurricane at all, but were able to somehow keep their focus and their calm in that moment, the energy, the collective energy in the room, all working together to create a sense of well-being.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is, as the saying goes, ignorance is bliss. So the fact that they had never been in a hurricane, they didn't know to be afraid. Right. And so that collective energy that we had and that we were all present to the very moment of what was happening inside the tent. We were actually in a tent up on Cape Cod having dinner outside in a tent up on Cape Cod having dinner with this group of 66 people, with probably the majority of them, more maybe about 60% of them being from Europe and having never experienced hurricanes before. So the beauty of that moment was that what was happening outside was irrelevant to just the presencing that we had together with that collective energy together in that same mindset to be present to what was in that moment and our environment, what was happening inside the tent, not what was happening outside the tent. Because as you know, the brain loves to be in that space of looking for threat. So if we were to let our human selves be in that moment, we would normally be worried about the threat. And that would have been distracting us from the beauty of what was happening for all of us collectively as we were having dinner inside the tent with a hurricane happening just about outside of the tent. It was coming up the tent, coming up the East Coast. It wasn't like right above us, but we had the wind and all of that happening while we were sitting there having dinner calmly with Europeans who've never experienced a hurricane.
So I know that a lot has happened since then, and I really want to spend sort of the majority of our time talking about two different things. One, and perhaps I think most important to me, is really the work that you're doing now. We talk about this neuroconsciousness. Huge fan of what I've learned about this from you. So I would love to give you an opportunity to expand on that and also to weave in how the sense of being present in any given moment has informed and affected your relationships with family members and friends. Because to me, that combination of what we do professionally and what we do personally is what real time is all about. When you and I were talking before, you were telling me, and I love this, you said, you know, your definition of mindfulness may be different from mine. And in fact, it isn't. It's just an adjunct to it. And that is, for you, that practice really is walking on the beach, walking in nature, being present to everything that's happening. I'm interested to know, Sonia, the work that you did around presencing, and then your work around the neuroleadership, where I first met you, and now how you've built on that into the neuroconsciousness. How is the parallel there for you in terms of being in that moment and using what you do, for example, to walk on a beach, to walk through nature, support your ability to do that?
Yeah, I think it's really important for everyone to have some type of practice. And as you stated, I'm not sitting on a cushion doing my mindfulness practices. And I think for me, it is being as much as possible to be in nature. Specifically, I live on the coast, so I like walking to the beach, walking on the beach. I don't walk to the beach, but walking on the beach, and or in nature of some kind. And I think the parallel to the mindfulness practice in and of itself, it informs our mindset. It informs our energy. It is how we show up in the world. The more mindful you are, and in my work, it's really all about building that self-awareness. And when you are tuned in, if you will, to your thoughts, your metacognition, thinking about your thinking, when you are tuned in to the mind-body consciousness, when you understand you're in a situation and what's happening in your body, what are the activations that are happening in your body in any given situation, when you have the ability to be present with what is in the moment, I think it makes you a better facilitator, a better coach, a better leader, because you are coming from a place of calm. You're not coming from a place of reaction. You know, as we say, it's always better to respond than to react. And so whenever you're coming from that place of responding, it means you're usually using your cognitive ability and not your affective ability or your emotions, letting them lead. And I think being able to have those moments, whether you're taking 5 minutes at your desk, whether you get up and walk outside or down the hall, or, you know, we're all working from home nowadays, a lot of people are, whether you just go out, you know, for a few minutes out of your office, whatever it is that one needs to do to have a moment to just ground yourself back in that place of self-awareness, no matter what's going on around you, and especially when things are happening that's disrupting your energy as it relates to your mindfulness, that really helps how you show up in the next things that you have to do, whatever's next on your calendar, for you to be in a place where you can be fully present to what is, where you can listen, not just listening to respond, but really listening to understand. And that's a whole nother conversation on the levels of listening. But that is where most leaders, people that I work with in particular, need to be. That's a skill set that they need to build. And it's like a muscle, as you know, the more you use it, the better it becomes and the stronger it becomes.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I'm hearing as you're saying that ability to be fully present, to listen to the content and the nonverbal aspects of what's being shared, leaving one's presumptions behind and bringing, and I think you and I had talked about this before, bringing that true sense of curiosity, right? Because so often what we're bringing into an interaction, into a conversation, is so informed by what we already know or what we think we know. But if we're really there and really listening and really being accessible to what's being shared with us with curiosity, and also think about that tent on Cape Cod, and I'm thinking about just being there the Europeans, not having been through this before, is like, whoa, this is interesting, right? And doing so without judgment. And that's where you also says, like, not thinking about, oh my gosh, we're going to be swept away. This is like Wizard of Oz, but it's like, huh, this is where we're at. Isn't this interesting? Mm-hmm. I love that. So thank you for that.
It's something I tell sometimes in some of my talks or either in a facilitation group, is have the curiosity of a four-year-old in life. I think we get to a point in life where we've had experiences that didn't maybe go the way we wanted them to go, or, you know, we've had different experiences that have sort of, we stopped dreaming, if you will. We stopped being curious. We are all so cautious because nobody wants to make a mistake. Well, first of all, let's normalize making a mistake. It's not really a mistake. It's an opportunity for growth. It's an opportunity to gather data. So if we could change our perception of what a mistake is, and just take that word completely out of our vocabulary, because the beauty that comes from that is, what did you learn? Now, going back to mindfulness and being present, what did you learn is a much better question than why did you do that, right? And so if we take that connotation of something bad happened and turn our minds into what information now do we have that we didn't have before as a result of whatever that situation is, and come again with curiosity. And that's leading with the curiosity, I like to say, of a four-year-old, because they're constantly asking why. That is the way that we need to get back to that. And we need to normalize and understand and sort of open our parachute, if you will, to understanding that when we are present and self-aware and not in that place of fear and risk and loss and, oh my gosh, it's terrible, that was awful. No. What did we learn? We always get data from things that didn't go as we expected them to go. And many times that data is what informs how we move forward. So there's always something to glean from any experience that we're having, specifically in our organizations, in our personal lives, things that happen, perhaps raising teenagers. They don't always make the right choice, but there's an opportunity there for them as well to be more self-aware and to reflect. The other thing I think is really important here is many people think that they learn by doing. And there's some truth to that. But I believe we learn by reflecting on what the action was. That's where the true learning happens. While you're doing it, you're still trying to figure it out. But the learning happens when you're not doing it and you're reflecting on what you did. And that helps you to learn whatever that skill set is, because now it's coming from the reflection. I believe it was John Dewey that said that. That we don't really learn by doing, we learn by reflecting on what we did.
Interesting. You know, it's so funny when you said that. I don't know why I suddenly had this image of the head coach of a football team watching
games. That's why they do it.
Right? And so playing the game is important. And if you don't play, you're not going to learn. However, it is very difficult to both do and learn at the same time. And I'm hearing that from you, and I'm like, yeah, which is why you look at the game film, or if you're an individual with your life, you spend some time reflecting. And so in my world, and I want to hear more about sort of how this would play out for you, in my world, that might come from sitting, closing my eyes, focusing on my breath, and then asking some pointed questions about, so what was this about? What did I learn here? You know, how am I reacting to this? Trying to stay away from the why word. And I heard you say that before too. It's like, why has all these implications, all these judgments? It makes me think of my mom and dad. Why did you do that? Right. But what and how and where and all those good words kind of bring up ways that we can say, oh, that's interesting. So this occurred. I reacted this way. As a result of that, what could I have done differently? And if I'd done this, So does that play into what you're thinking?
Yeah, and it goes even deeper. So to me, the first level is reflection. thinking about what transpired, right? And really understanding from different perspectives. So you're thinking what's transpired because you were there. The other piece is to take it even deeper and become something of introspection. So what was my role in that situation? What can I learn from how I reacted or didn't react, or what I should have said and I didn't say, or, you know, what was my part in whatever that situation was? And then I think that's the piece where the self-awareness comes up, because in reflection, you're just sort of going over like a movie of what happened, right? But then you have to internalize into the introspective piece of what is the learning for you in that moment. And I think that is what's most important. And then I think the other piece is a lot of the work I do is with teams. And so no two brains are alike. You know, we've all heard this before, right? No two brains are alike. And so we can't assume that other people had the same experience we had, even though we were all in the same room. Their perception of what happened might differ from your perception of what happened. Because as you said earlier, we have a whole lot of stuff that we are used to, that we experiences that we've each had that cloud sometimes our judgment around certain things. And so for these situations, when we're reflecting and in that place of introspection, it is a good idea once you get back in a team situation, or maybe even a family situation, when you get back together with your team, is to have a conversation around what did other people reflect and introspect, and what came up for them, things that they didn't see in the moment, but now through reflection and introspection, they were able to glean other information that was important to whatever the situation was, that help you to move forward in a way that really serves, if you will, the whole, as opposed to just me or you.
So this sounds like this is, in many respects, the heart and soul and mind of the neuroconscious training and coaching that you're doing.
Yes. So my work is grounded in adult development theory. And and in my mind, humans are, we live in this world of three different dimensions. We operate from three different dimensions. One, our cognitive dimension, which is our thoughts. The second is our affective dimension, which are our emotions. And the third is the behavioral dimension, which are our actions and behaviors. And so when we understand each one of those dimensions and how they play out on a day-to-day basis in our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, being more consciously aware of the decisions that we're making and not making those decisions from all of our experiences. And maybe I should say at this point, for each one of us, no matter how many years old you are today, all of your life, your subconscious mind has been keeping a database of every experience you've had. Some of them you remember and some of them you don't remember, but they have been keeping a database, and you have been reacting to things in certain ways over the years that have become habits. And so whenever you're in a situation that you have, that might be happening right now, your subconscious, your brain is going to take a record, almost go through that database as quickly as it can to figure out, have we been in this situation before and how do we handle it? Because the brain, I'm just going to say it, not personal to anyone, your brain is lazy. Okay, it's lazy. It doesn't want to use a lot of energy. Your PFC right here is your executive center, and it doesn't like to work. So it relies on all those past experiences to help you get through life and save it a lot of energy. So we have to be self-aware that that's happening so we can be more conscious of our decisions, making conscious decisions and not relying on our subconscious, which a lot of the statistics are that 95% of our behaviors are ruled by our subconscious mind and not being made consciously. So think about that for a moment. you're only consciously making decisions 5% of the time or thereabouts. 95% of the time, you are making decisions that have been stored in that big, huge database that's constantly taking in every environment in which you're in, because its job is to keep you safe. And that's why it's more attuned to threat than it is to reward. That was a lot, I know.
Yeah, and I'm also aware, I think, I don't know the exact percentage, but you talk about, so over 90% of your decisions are made subconsciously. That's a scary, scary thought. One of the things that I've become aware of is that close to 50% of our time is spent mind-wandering. Right? Which plays into that. And I think you mentioned the metacognition, you know, that sense in our mindfulness practice of being able to catch ourselves thinking about how we're thinking, and understanding, again, with curiosity and without judgment, that, okay, so I wasn't present at this moment. Okay, let me bring myself back. And when you do that, it sounds like that's really putting you in a much better position to make actively well thought out, well reasoned responses and or decisions. But we can't do that if we're in la-la land. Yeah. And a certain amount of time in la-la land, not so bad. But what I think is sort of driving both of us in these wonderful parallel ways is that we want to know that we've got our hand on the tiller, right? That if we're in this sort of mythical sailboat through life, that we have some control over where we're going. We may not be able to control the wind, but we can decide how we sail into the wind and therefore be able to tack, for example, and get where we need to go with intention. But if our hand is not on the tiller, if our subconscious is manning the wheel, who knows where we end up, right?
And that's what we have to really be thinking about, because it's that being self-aware enough to make a conscious decision, and knowing that, and here's the thing, having the knowledge, most people don't have the knowledge that 95% of their behaviors or their decisions are being made by their subconscious mind. And that's that piece I think is really important to note, is when we say decisions, they usually result in an action or a behavior that impacts not only you, specifically in organizations, also in families, that impacts not only you, but anyone else in that is going to be impacted by it. It's usually you, your team, possibly the organization, possibly customer base, possibly the environment in which your organization, you know, serves, whatever the case may be. So we have to remember that it's when you say, oh, well, I made a decision. Well, you made a decision that really is an action or a behavior on some level that extends beyond you. And I think that is the piece that people really need to understand, because most people have never heard that 95% of their, or over 90% of their decisions are made by their subconscious mind. So the more that you can disrupt that natural tendency to allow that to happen, you have to be mindful and conscious in any given moment of what is happening with you. And we can't control how other people are going to react or respond to whatever it is we're saying, but we can control how we react or respond to whatever is happening in any environment in which we find ourselves. And I think that's super important. That goes back to your mindfulness piece of being consciously aware of your decision-making process. Getting back up here to lazy, who doesn't want to work, and making lazy work so that you can make a conscious decision that serves everyone and is in the best interest of everyone.
Yeah.
And then I think it's also important, I'm going on again, but I think it's also important specifically for leaders. If you're going to make a decision, I led a national consulting team in the healthcare industry. And they had one saying, my team had one saying, if it's about, it can't, a decision can't be made about us without us. Now, I personally love autonomy. I like to have choices. So I like to give my team choices because it's important for people where that is something that really, you know, gets them upset if they don't have a choice. So sometimes we don't have a lot of latitude for choices that your team can make because you've got some directives that have come above your pay level. But always try to find some choice within the parameters that they can have so that they can feel like they have some type of skin in the game, that they have some autonomy, they're not being micromanaged, that is within the realm of possibility for them to be able to make some type of a decision so that they don't have that feeling of being told what to do. Because most people really don't want to be told what to do, especially adults. We like to make decisions on our own. So I think that piece is also equally important. If you're making decisions that are going to impact your team in particular, have conversations with them, feel them out. What are they thinking? And knowing from the very beginning, I always say, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to have to make the best decision I can based on what, you know, on all of the factors, including all the information that you all are sharing with me, including other information that I'm getting from other sources. But I really want to know what you all are thinking. And I can't promise it's going to go exactly as you would like it to go. But I want you to know I am taking those things into consideration. And to the extent that I can, they will be part of the decision.
Catching oneself in that process, I would think. Catching oneself being open and clear and accessible to what the input's being given before those choices are made, right? And that's, again, where that presence, that mindfulness piece really comes in, because we can think that we're doing all that you described, which I think, if done skillfully, leads to really nice results. And by the way, I was just thinking, this one quote came to my mind. It was like, attention comes before choice, and choice comes before results. And right. And that awareness of where we're putting our attention, that begins that process. That's the beginning of that equation. And it plays right into, I think, what you were saying. And the self-awareness to catch those moments when our old habits are reemerging and our, you know, our subconscious is taking over, our ego, whatever you want to say, but being aware enough to go, whoa, wait a minute. I asked a question. I wanted an honest answer. The answer was being given to me honestly. And I started to react. It's like,
where's that?
If you really want people to be able to respond authentically, and you've asked them for their honest input, wait for it.
And I think there's another point here specifically for leaders, and that is not to give your opinion about anything first, because you hold influence over these people and power on some level around their performance reviews, you know, whether they're going to get promoted or not. Some organizations actually need, or I don't know if they're still doing this, but you need a recommendation or the ability to apply for another position within the organization from your supervisor. And so there's a lot of power and influence there. So it's really important for leaders to allow everyone else to speak and not give an opinion. Because once you've stated what you want, that could be intimidating to some personalities on your team, not necessarily for all. And it also goes to how you lead and what the culture is on your team. Doesn't matter what the culture is in the organization, because you create the culture for your team, which could be completely different than the organization's culture. So we want to keep that in mind. And so it's really important for you to hold back what your thoughts around any of the situations are that you might be discussing with your team, and allow them to speak freely before you venture, give any indication of what your thoughts are on it.
That's hugely important. And I wanted to get back to you personally, sort of bring this into the real-time aspects of it, because this plays in, everything you described plays into our ability to be our best self, whether we're leading or responding to leadership, by being present and open and all that good stuff and self-aware. I'm interested to know, Sonia, and let's begin, I guess, professionally. Using all the techniques that you've described, how does it play into how you show up as a coach, as a trainer, as a facilitator?
Well, it informs who I am. It's not something that I just started. So it's been a part of who I was from probably high school, when I didn't even know what it was, right? I was tuned into, I have a talk that I've done. I did an Oxford Talks last fall where I talk about the hidden navigator. And I was tuned into this hidden navigator, which is really just yourself at a higher level, if you will, your consciousness, right? Your higher self or whatever you want to call it. And I was very tuned into that, probably high school, definitely college. And it just informed who I was and how I wanted to show up and how I did show up in the world. Now, was I a perfect being all the time? No, there were times when I wasn't proud of my behavior, probably more in my 20s than at any other point. We're all growing during that period, and we all think we're so grown and we know everything and all of that. And we do know some things. We know more than we knew when we were younger and in our teens, but we still have a lot to learn. And I believe we always have a lot to learn. No matter how old we are, you and I have both been around the sun a few times for decades. And I'm still learning, and that's the beauty of life. And I think for me, the work that I do now is the work that has always been a part of me, but it has now become front and center of how I want to work in the world, become front and center for the work that I'm doing to help individuals become more self-aware, to not be afraid of change and to embrace that change, because with change comes innovation, new ideas, things that we didn't think about before. Because if we continue to do as we've always done, we'll always be where we currently are. So there's no growth in that. And we must grow. We must innovate. And in order for us to innovate, we have to let go of those unconscious decision-making processes and be more conscious to what's happening. We must listen to other people's ideas, even when we are the boss, and get more information as to how things could possibly work better. This consciousness piece is not necessarily about, as you said before, sitting on a cushion or my favorite thing at the beach or walking through nature. You've got to learn to be conscious in every single moment as much as you possibly can. Now, is it easy? Not necessarily. Is it possible? Absolutely. Right? And so when we can be conscious in the moment to what is happening and attuned with our emotional intelligence around what other people or whatever we're getting from other people, when we can be in that place of having high emotional intelligence, we can be in that place of being mindful, even if it's for 5 minutes, take it and run with it. When we can be there, when we can go there in the moment, Clayton, that is power. That is power. As they say today, that's fire. That's what that is.
I love it. And it is. And just, I want to share with you, as you describe that, tuning into how my body reacts to things, I had these huge goosebumps because it was resonating so deeply. And one of the things that I wanted to share is that tuning into how our body reacts, and I know this is sort of part of your paradigm, tuning into how our body reacts, I think, and being aware, feeling those messages our body is sending us, there's huge power in that. And everything that you described just resonates so deeply. And I was thinking about the importance of being present, bringing that beginner's mind, that child view. I was thinking, and I don't have the exact quote, but I believe that Rachel Carson wrote about, you know, the gift of children being staying with that child's view and being able to maintain that throughout your life, if it's at all possible, is magic in itself. For me, in my world, the building of that muscle has come from a meditation practice. Good for me. That's where I come from. And I believe in it. I recommend it, but I also really understand that there are quite a number of people for whom that traditional formal practice doesn't play perhaps a regular or even any part of their lives, but they've worked at strengthening the awareness muscle on a daily basis by doing things intentionally. Oh,
great word.
Right? So, right? And we can't get that. We can't, you don't become stronger if you don't work out somehow. It doesn't mean going to the gym, but you have to do something to exercise your muscles. And what you've described to me in the past, again, was in those walks, in those hikes, in those moments, that's when you make the intention to say, I want to be present for what's around me. And sometimes we can be out in mind wander, and that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. But if we want to strengthen that awareness to say, pull ourselves back into the present and aware so that we can do all the things you described in terms of conscious decision making, right? Then we need to intentionally build that presence around our walk, around listening to music, for example. Sometimes just listening and just absorbing that music, all the different notes and hearing things in a song that you've heard 1,000 times, but paying enough attention that you heard a harmony you never heard before, or a bass line, right? One other thing that I wanted to circle back, because it was really hit me, because I know you're doing such great work around change and being agile in the face of change. And you and I, with our backgrounds in neuroleadership, would sing from the same page of the hymnal, so to speak. Change frightens us. Our minds are wired to avoid threat, absolutely. And yet, our minds love novelty. And to me, that juxtaposition plays right into how we frame what we're seeing and experiencing. Because if we're aware that we're starting to react with threat to, oh my goodness, I'm uncertain, I don't have control, and we can reframe and say, huh, that's funny. I'm a European who's never lived through a hurricane before.
They didn't know what to expect.
I don't know enough to be scared. I'm like, listen to the tent. Are we going to take off? Are we going to fly to the moon? Right? And I'd love to hear a little bit of that from you, because to me, being able to harness and feel the felt sense of, I've never done that before. That felt good, right?
So being in the tent, I wasn't focused, if that's what you're asking. Ask the question again. I want to make sure I answer the right question.
Oh, so the question is broader than that. It isn't necessarily specifically about that moment in the tent, but rather, here's the question. That dichotomy in the brain between being wired overwhelmingly to avoid threat and to notice and move away from it versus noticing change and the novelty and the wonder of something happening for the first time.
Yeah.
In your work, how do you sort of support that?
Well, it's important to... There's two trains of thought, and the one that that I like best. And it really depends on the group and when I get a sense of who they are and how they process things, because most people think change is the problem. Change is not the problem. The problem is how we respond and react to change, right? And we all have the power to decide what that's going to be. And so for me, it's having them think, because the initial thought is, oh, it's going to be the worst thing. It's just going to be terrible, right? And this is just not going to work. It's going to do this and it's going to make that. And I mean, you could make a laundry list of all the terrible things that are going to happen based on whatever the change is that's happening in any organization, whether it is, you know, the mission's changing, whether you're part of a merger and acquisition and you're the acquisition group. Are they going to still have a role for you? And most times people think, well, the group that's doing the acquiring, their jobs are all safe. Not necessarily, because you've got two companies where you may have two different, the same positions with, now you have two of these people, and who's going to stay and who's going to go and all of those things. I mean, that's just one thing in mergers and acquisitions. And the other thing could be around a new policy that's being implemented. Perhaps it's a DE&I situation. Perhaps it's, you know, things that they're trying to do in employee engagement piece. Maybe it's things that they're trying to do around a new performance management system that they're going to be implementing. A list could be as long as, you know, Santa's list, if you will, about things that could happen. But the idea is why to be aware that we immediately go to the worst case scenario instinctively, it's first. And what I try to do is to say, that could be the scenario, but what if it was better than that? What would that look like? Let's flip the switch for a moment and think about how might this change be positive? How might this change turn around certain aspects of the work that you do? How could this possibly be a moment for innovation and curiosity? Let's leave a little space for grace that it's possible that it could actually be the best thing. You are making a decision based on that subconscious and experiences that you've had in the past, and those details may not even be applicable to this situation. So we got to get back up here in the lazy and put it to work so we can begin to consciously think about what are the other options that could possibly, or scenarios that could possibly make this a good thing. Because then we go back to presencing, where we are creating the future as it is emerging. Because now we're thinking about, because part of the neuroconscious foresight work beyond the human operating system and understanding of the cognitive and the affective and the behavioral is, and also we didn't talk about it, but we also do some work around brain state so people understand exactly what brain state they're in and how to shift and to recognize it, how to shift it and how to maintain it. But then we need to be able to think about this piece on how open are we to new possibilities? So the foresight work is about, let's think 10 years in the future, not 3 months, not 6 months, not a year. Let's think 10 years in the future. What do you see your industry doing? Or where do you think your industry could possibly be at that time? And how do you future-proof for that situation? Because if that's the ideal situation that you would like to be in 10 years from now, how do we begin today to begin to create that future so that it is being created as we are, the future is emerging? And that's the work, because that's where you get people to think about the pinnacle of where they want their organization to be and to be working towards that now, so that we can circumvent those reactionary instances that could possibly come up, because change is the one constant that we have in life. And so we want to be, first of all, build that muscle around it could be good, just as equally as it could not be good. But what if it is? And what is it that we're trying to work towards? And why don't we start that now?
You know, and I think you and I had talked about this before, that sense of visualization, that creating the future memory, I'm a huge fan of that, knowing that, as you said, the brain's keeping this database of all the things that have happened. When we create that visualization, that future memory, that's part of the algorithm. And the brain doesn't distinguish what was really happened in the past and what you have now visualized. It's like, that's part of the...
It doesn't know time.
Right. And right. And one of the other pieces of this that excites me so much, and it's part of one of the things that I build into some of my mindfulness teaching, is, again, I wouldn't use... I personally don't use the word future-proof. I love that term, by the way. So if I use it, I will give it due credit. But here's what I'm going to say. But from a personal standpoint, right, how we set our GPS to become that best version of ourselves. So individuals on the path of building either their better future or their organization's better future based on change, being able to visualize what that change looks like, visualizing overcoming obstacles, right? And then here's the other part that I think can be so important and where some of that magic lies is actually feeling, getting that felt sense of overcoming the obstacle and accomplishing that goal and seeing that change play out and having your organization and yourself be the best versions of yourselves in 10 years. What does that feel like? And that creates, in many respects, it ties the bow on the brain's ability to go, well, I want that, right? But that felt good. It's like visualizing the pain of change and the possibility of failure versus all the things that can go right, and visualizing the result of that, the outcomes and the feelings tied to that, to me is a beautiful, it's a beautiful bow on that. And I think that the work that you're doing is so critically important. And I understand why we haven't gotten there yet. But that's where the opportunity lies for Sonia, because, you know, 40 years ago, if you told someone you were going to go to a yoga studio, they would look at you askance. You know, if you told them 40 years ago you were going to be meditating, they were going, oh, you're going to Thailand. But working into now the sense of neuroconscious foresight, people need to hear about it. People need to experience it and see the value of it. And boy, I hope people are listening, because those possibilities excite me. And there's no better person that I can think of to introduce them to these concepts and lead them through to that success point than you. So I'm so grateful for this. And Sonia, thank you so much for this time together. And I wish you all the best with that. And I also so appreciate your vision on the walks, the hikes, the being present. That just reinforces mindfulness can be practiced in so many different ways.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. And it's an individual choice to do these things. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I want to take a moment to thank my producer, Marianne Sanders, as well as my friends at Meditation for Leadership in helping launch this podcast. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt, encouraging you to look for those moments of magic in your life where mindfulness plays out in real time.